Hello, and welcome to A History of Japan. Season 10, Episode 3, The Pax Nobunaga. Before we begin this episode in earnest, I have a quick note to make regarding a name change for Hashiba Tokichiro. I was under the impression that his first name was changed in the late 1570s, but while looking over my research, I saw that sometime in late 1572, he began to be known by a different given name, Hideyoshi. I apologize for the oversight. I'll try to be more careful of these things moving forward. With that said, I will refer to him as Hashiba Hideyoshi going forward, but be warned, once more, that this is still not his final name change. I promise the next one will be the final form. While the primary focus of today's episode is the administration of Nobunaga's quasi-government, there are a few important events we need to cover before digging into the exciting world of micropolitics and macroeconomics. First, we should discuss some of Oda Nobunaga's children. 5 sons and a daughter had been born to the man formerly known as the Fool of Owari, and they all played a part in his growing political power. He groomed his eldest son, Nobutada, to take over his responsibilities governing Owari and Mino provinces. Nobutada was also gaining a reputation as a fierce and clever general, having defended the Oda army against a potentially devastating night attack by Takeda troops before the Battle of Nagashino. Nobunaga trusted him, and by all accounts, that trust was justified. His second son, Nobukatsu, however, had a somewhat rougher time in his father's shadow. He had been married to the daughter of Kitabatake Tomonori of southern Ise province and officially named as the heir to the Kitabatake clan as part of a truce arrangement between the southern Ise clan and the Oda during their gradual subjugation of Ise province. In 1575, he took his place at the head of the Kitabatake clan and shortly thereafter arranged for the assassination of the previous Kitabatake chieftain and arrested his own father-in-law in an effort to consolidate his power within the clan. In 1578, no doubt spurred in part by jealousy for the fame which his brother Nobutada seemed to be accumulating, Oda Nobukatsu decided to pick a fight with the neighboring province. The residents of Iga province made no effort to hide their disdain for higher authority and had expelled the man who was, at least on paper, their rightful shugo. When a former Kitabatake vassal complained to Nobukatsu of the alleged depredations of the residents of Iga, he saw an opportunity to expand his domain. He ordered Takigawa Kazumasu, a trusted longtime retainer of the Oda clan, to begin making preparations for an invasion of Iga province by building a castle in an area of southern Iga province called Maruyama. The residents of Iga province soon became aware of the construction and correctly surmised that Oda Nobukatsu had hostile intent. In late November 1578, they attacked the castle while it was still under construction, managing to achieve complete surprise over their enemies, who soon fled. The castle in progress was put to the torch as Takigawa Kazumasu reorganized his fleeing troops and prepared to counterattack. This counterattack also failed, and the defeated warriors fled back to Ise Province. Furious but undeterred, Oda Nobukatsu organized a large invasion consisting of 3 separate forces which would attack the mountainous province in a coordinated manner. In October of 1579, nearly a year after the disaster at Maruyama, Nobukatsu led an army totaling around 8,000 into Iga province, commanding the largest portion of around 6,000 himself, while the other 2, around 1,500 each, were led by trusted generals. Once more, the people of Iga province were completely aware of their ambitious neighbor's plan, and they ambushed his main army while it was still traveling through the perilously narrow Nagano Pass. They likewise attacked the smaller auxiliary forces which were also making their way through narrow passes, managing to inflict heavy casualties and even killing one of Nobukatsu's generals. We aren't certain how many of his troops were lost to the ambuscades of provincial ninja, but it was at least 1,000, and in my opinion was probably greater than 3,000. Nobukatsu had hoped that attaining victory on the battlefield and subjugating rebellious Iga province would earn him the respect and admiration of his father. He hadn't bothered communicating any of his ill-fated actions to Nobunaga, but eventually confessed the entire disaster. His father's reaction was extremely unpleasant. He berated Nobukatsu for his incompetence and even threatened to disown him and cast him out of the Oda family. While thus far in the podcast we have largely focused on Oda Nobunaga as a warrior, leader, and a politician, part of what I want to cover in this episode is Nobunaga the man. While his strategic insight and tactical genius attracted many capable samurai to his banner, his personality and management style appear to have been real liabilities. You may recall from last season that in his younger years, Nobunaga's behavior was so offensive at his father's funeral that his mentor committed suicide out of shame. Although Nobunaga later built a shrine in the man's name, there is little evidence that his successes both on the battlefield and in the political arena did anything to temper his massive ego. Although he was famously gregarious in the aftermath of great victories, he was equally dour after defeats. Clever retainers like Hashiba Hideyoshi became adept at avoiding him when he was in one of his famous moods. If he was willing to threaten disownment of his own son after a public failure, you can imagine how much more dangerous it was for vassals and retainers to show their face after failing the great man. While I have contended that Nobunaga's political foresight and tendency toward unifying stability marked him as different than the Miyoshi and Hosokawa clans who controlled the capital before him, he was still capable of intense, scathing cruelty. Subjecting the residents of the Nagashima Fortress complex to a burning death when they had already offered surrender was just one of the many times in which Nobunaga walked the path of terror rather than benevolence. You may also remember the more famous scouring of the temple complex atop Mount Hiei last season, in which non-combatants were likewise killed alongside those who actively resisted. While some might attribute Nobunaga's cruelty as merely part of his overall strategy for unification, it is apparent from his treatment of subordinates that he probably had what we would call an anger problem. He would frequently dismiss or demote retainers, vassals, and generals when they would fail on the battlefield or in the political arena. Many of these underlings were longtime subordinates who had often served Nobunaga with absolute loyalty, and treating them like replaceable henchmen would prove to be a fatal mistake. There are many tales of Nobunaga's cruelty, some apocryphal and others having a ring of truth. Arguably, the most ostentatious of these is the story of the Golden Skulls. Nobunaga allegedly arranged for the skulls of three of his enemies, two leaders of the Azai clan and the daimyo of the Asakura clan, to be dipped in gold and the very tops of their heads cut into sake saucers so that he could drink from them. While often repeated and frequently portrayed in historical fiction, the truth behind this story is strongly doubted by historians. It seems very likely to have been fabricated after Nobunaga's death as a testament to his boundless cruelty. Although his governing style could rightly be described as dictatorial, his political policies reveal that he had a deeper understanding of socioeconomic factors than his predecessors and many of his rivals. To begin an exploration of these policies, we must look to the crown jewel of Nobunaga's domain, a specially built and lavishly adorned fortress built atop Mount Azuchi in Omi Province, just southeast of Lake Biwa. Construction of Azuchi Castle began in 1576 under the guidance of Niwa Nagahide. A lifelong Nobunaga supporter from his early days, Nagahide undertook a monumental task of creating a fortress that was both a practical, defendable structure, while also offering a lavish interior that expressed Nobunaga's power through the opulent display of luxury. The location of this castle was meant to further cement Nobunaga's authority over Kansai, while also providing a staging point for potential future incursions to the northeast, where the Uesugi still lay entrenched. The first order of business in constructing this castle was importing great blocks of stone which would serve as its foundation. This was no easy task, but was accomplished by massive groups of laborers bringing the selected stones from nearby quarries by pulling them on ox carts. Getting the stones up the mountain required large crews with levers and manpower inching the blocks to where they were stacked into a large trapezoidal prism which composed the castle's base. The entire castle's construction took 4 years and was finally completed in 1579. When finished, it was equal parts domineering medieval fortress and beautiful work of art. Its tenchu, or main keep, is believed to have been 46 meters tall, that's 150 feet, and included an octagonal structure called a belvedere, which is like a large balcony from which the surrounding countryside and lake could be seen. Lower on Mount Azuchi, various potential defensive enclosures were established with stone walls, but residences and market areas were also built. It was Nobunaga's intention that Azuchi Castle not only be a beautiful, mighty fortress, but that it would grow into a thriving castle town. Unfortunately, the castle has since been destroyed, and only artistic depictions and written descriptions exist today. There is a reproduction of its main keep in Mie Prefecture, whose modern borders include Ise Province, and it is quite beautiful, if perhaps a bit fanciful. Still, it is the closest thing we have to associate with Nobunaga's impressive fortress today, which is why I used it as inspiration for this season's logo. Part of the reason why this period is named the Azuchi Momoyama period is because of the construction and development of Azuchi Castle. In addition to building fine residences and civilian-friendly areas of what he hoped would grow into a thriving castle town, Nobunaga also pursued trade-friendly policies in Azuchi, which had previously met with great success. You may recall that last season we spent some time discussing trade guilds, or za, and the ways in which they sought patronage from the power players in the Ashikaga shogunate. The guilds gained protection and support from their patrons and government, who only asked a modest, or sometimes more than modest, tax in return. By the Sengoku period, however, this system of mutual benefit had all but collapsed. The Ashikaga shogunate gradually lost any ability to control trade, and the black market thrived as chaos engulfed the usual gatekeepers of official economic activity. The Hosokawa and Miyoshi displayed no particular gift for economic management and saw legitimate trade as something to be looted for personal gain. Nobunaga had a different approach to such matters. Rather than try and repair the old system, which was in a practically unfixable state, he abolished guilds, abolished tariffs and other trade taxes, demolished many toll barriers, and established a system called Rakuichi, which means free trade. This helped attract more merchants to his domains, which led to economic activity and gradually helped the civilian economy to recover from so many years of stagnation and decline. It also attracted skilled artisans to Oda clan domains whom Nobunaga and his agents could recruit and set to work supporting their war efforts. Establishing free trade and removing some, but not all, of the road toll barriers were not unique innovations of Nobunaga, and had been attempted by many daimyo before him in their own attempts to cultivate a thriving trade market. However, these particular measures did not carry the ideological weight in medieval Japan which they possess today. Free trade and semi-free movement were adopted by Nobunaga because they fit his grand strategy of unifying the nation under his rule. By embracing free trade, he was seizing control of the economy with the intention of reintroducing taxation at a later time, probably on a gradual basis. As regards Azuchi, the castle town he was trying to grow and which he was openly considering trying to transform into a new national capital, the benefits for potential residents were even greater. While it was still being built in 1577, Nobunaga issued a municipal charter, essentially a list of laws for his new city. Unsurprisingly, it was founded as a free market with no taxation on buying or selling. But there were also requirements for travelers passing through the region, namely that any merchants traveling on the nearby Nakasendo Road were forbidden from passing through the town without availing themselves of lodging within the town. Residents enjoyed freedom from the customary levies for large building projects or transport duties, except in the case of emergency, and creditors living in Azuch were exempted from any debt cancellation issued within the boundaries of Omi Province. All of these measures were, again, not issued out of benevolence, but out of a desire to gain control over regional commerce and thus expand Nobunaga's influence. It would be incomplete to neglect discussing one of the most important aspects of trade in Japan during Nobunaga's hegemony, the Nanban trade. European goods and religious clergy continued pouring into Japan during Nobunaga's tenure, and the port city of Sakai was one of the main avenues through which European culture was introduced to Japan in the late 1500s. Located on the eastern coast of the Inland Sea and not terribly far from Kyoto itself, Sakai was one of the most influential trade centers of the latter days of Sengoku Jidai, and the writings of many Jesuits living there at the time survives today. Before its capitulation to Nobunaga, the city had been governed by a council of 36 wealthy merchants and was described by Jesuit visitors as a free city, with one writer even comparing it to Venice. When Nobunaga entered Kyoto in 1568, however, he soon gained control of Sakai, whose council capitulated amid threats of invasion and demands for a war tax payment. Kyoto was a popular destination for Jesuit missionaries, who were often accompanied by European merchants hawking foreign clothes, guns, and any other trade goods they had managed to transport from their distant homes. Nobunaga was an avid Europhile, and was only too happy to host foreign dignitaries and missionaries. While he tended toward often violent suppression of powerful Buddhist sects, he was extremely favorable toward Christianity. When some of the more influential Buddhist schools of Kansai tried to persuade the emperor to order the expulsion of this foreign religion, Nobunaga ensured that no such edict was ever issued, and even extended protection to the Jesuits. That being said, it is probably a mistake to assume that Nobunaga was interested in potentially becoming a Christian himself. Like his economic policies, he favored protecting the foreign missionaries because doing so suited his larger ends, in this case, splintering the power of large religious majorities which he saw as a threat to his own suzerainty. In 1581, Nobunaga encountered a man who was neither of European nor East Asian origin, but was indeed a black African. Though it is still debated, it seems likely that the man was enslaved, but whatever the nature of his servitude, he attended an Italian Jesuit priest named Alessandro Valignano. This African man was not the first black person to come to Japan, but he may have been the first which Nobunaga had ever personally seen. According to one latter-day account of dubious origin, Nobunaga believed that the man was merely covered in some kind of paint and attempted to wash the black off his skin with soap and water. Uncomfortable and likely untrue anecdotes aside, Nobunaga decided to take this man into his service as a samurai, giving him the name Yasuke. There are naturally endless debates about Yasuke's place of origin within Africa, but frankly, it's a matter that is well above my pay grade. He was tall and his skin was said to be very dark, and when Nobunaga recruited him, he was given his own residence and granted the title of weapons bearer for Nobunaga himself. By all accounts, he served admirably as a warrior during the short time he served the most powerful daimyo in Japan, but we will discuss his fate in a few episodes. In addition to his affinity for the novelty of foreign visitors, Nobunaga also enjoyed a great many hobbies within Japanese culture. He was an avid Go player, which is unsurprising given his propensity for conquest. He also loved sumo wrestling and sponsored massive Joran Zumo tournaments at Azuch Castle, in which participants would compete in front of the emperor. According to some accounts, Entrants in these tournaments were accepted regardless of social class, and all competed together whether rich or poor, powerful or marginalized. Although he appreciated the imperial court while competing against Ashikaga Yoshiaki, he also intended to bring it fully under his control. In 1574, he went so far as to request that the Emperor Ogimachi abdicate the throne. The sovereign surprisingly agreed, but in a truly inspired bit of political sleight of hand, the actual abdication was continually delayed and did not take place until after Nobunaga was dead. You may also recall that the imperial court occasionally interfered in Nobunaga's conflicts, sometimes delaying his plans for months. While Nobunaga and his retainers may have chafed at the need to respect the imperial court, as in most other matters, Nobunaga found ways to make it work in his favor. When a problem with the court arose, they employed one of their favorite and most time-honored methods for placating a powerful overseer: court rank promotion and selection for higher office. By the time Nobunaga's death came about, he was officially the Daijō Daijin, or Chancellor, the highest office in the imperial court, save for the emperor himself. These titles and offices had, obviously, long since lost any actual authority, but they were still considered great honors, and Nobunaga could wield them effectively in the larger political arena, casting his personal enemies as enemies of the state. Some modern historians, many of them Japanese, have tried to make a case that the relationship between Nobunaga and the imperial court was hostile, even going so far in some cases as claiming that the court had arranged for Nobunaga's untimely death, which we will discuss in the next episode. However, the evidence for such a conspiracy is sparse and often circumstantial. Even if they viewed one another with suspicion and distrust, Nobunaga continually honored the emperor and his court publicly, regardless of any personal animosity he might feel. Claiming to act on the emperor's behalf often meant going against some of Nobunaga's darker inclinations. In 1580, the Ishiyama Honganji fortress near Sakai finally surrendered after a decade of siege and attempted assaults. We will review some of these specifics in more detail in the next episode, but for now it suits our purposes to note that the Ikkō-ikki leaders at Ishiyama offered surrender after the emperor wrote them a letter promising clemency if they gave up. Given how Nobunaga handled the attempted surrender at the Nagashima fortress complex a few years before, there can be little doubt that he chafed at being forced to allow these dangerous enemies to escape unpunished. He burned the fortress to the ground after it had been evacuated, but some of his most trusted retainers felt his wrath soon afterward. He dismissed both Sakuma Nobumori and Ando Morinari from his service, and they returned to their homes in shame. These were long-time supporters who arguably did not deserve such a harsh response for failing to accomplish an impossible task. This petulant tendency to alienate long-standing supporters would have dire consequences for Nobunaga, as they would not be on hand when a dramatic betrayal emerged in 1582. Nobunaga's legacy is one of both far-seeing political acumen and gut-wrenching abject cruelty. While he can rightly be credited with setting Japan on the path to unification, his tendency toward vicious inhumanity when dealing with both enemies and subordinates cannot be ignored in any historical estimation of the man. In A History of Japan, 1334-1615, author and historian George Sansom sums him up thusly, quote, "He became the master of 20 provinces at a terrible cost. He was a cruel and callous brute." End quote. There is a poem regarding the events of the Azuchi Momoyama period and the three powerful men who defined the era, using a sweet mochi rice cake as a metaphor for ruling the nation. I will give its recitation in full at the end of the season, but it begins, "Nobunaga pounded the rice." While he provided critical early steps in what proved to be a much longer and larger process, he would neither see the unification of all Japan in his lifetime, nor would he enjoy the benefits of its peace. Next time, we will explore Nobunaga's final years and discuss the events that led to his death in 1582. Until then, thank you for listening. If you would like access to exclusive bonus episodes, as well as ad-free versions of the regular episodes, please consider supporting this podcast at patreon.com/ahistoryofjapan.